For any Arabic speakers here, I apologize for my North African accent, but I want to begin, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. No words are spoken more often by Muslims than in the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. And one would expect that with those repeated words, people would understand mercy and compassion are important. But why should Muslims get that better any more than Christians get the God of love and the killing in the name of the God of love, or Jews get the God of loving kindness and there is killing in the name of that God too? I'm inundated by Islamophobia all of the time, from all kinds of sources, from all different religious traditions. And maybe, unfortunately for me, or the people that send me this stuff, I actually know something. And I've actually experienced life and living with Muslims and found out something. Islam is made up of human beings. Now, I know this is shocking because if you just watch the pictures on TV or some of the films that we make, and I'm not even talking about that one, you would think that they were different creatures with different DNA, completely unlike ourselves. We are the same human beings with the same capacity for inhumanity as every other group, faith, or ethnicity. We worship, yes, the same God with many of the same stories. Eid celebration, and there are two major Eids in Islam. The one that is coming up this week is a story with which every Jew and every Christian is familiar, only with a slight change of caste members. And Abraham took his son Isaac to the mountaintop. Isaac rode a donkey, carried the wood for his own sacrifice up to the mount, and was bound on the mount to be sacrificed. And Ibrahim took Ishmael to the mount, carried the wood for his sacrifice, and he was bound on the wood to be sacrificed. And Jesus rode a donkey to the city where he would be judged and sacrificed, carried the wood for his own crucifixion up the mount, and was bound on it as a sacrifice. Same motifs, same stories. Nothing so completely foreign, horrifying on its surface, of course. But God, in the stories, stays the hand of Ibrahim, and a ram or lamb is placed instead of the child. And there are two lessons that the religious generate from this. One is that Ibrahim was a good and holy man because he was willing to submit to the will of God. We can talk about that. The second is that God does not demand human sacrifice anymore. God does not demand the sacrifice of our children anymore. Human beings may kill each other. Causes may be righteous or not righteous, but the killing of other human beings is never a holy act. It is the opposite of a holy act. So much that we have in common. Same God, doing business in the same location for 5,000 years. Again, depending on your interpretation. Same God. Allah is simply Arabic for Al-Illah, the God, which is derived from the Hebrew word Eloah, which is the singular form of Elohim, meaning the God. How different are these faiths? We look at the world and at the news, And we see angry Muslims all over the place, yelling and shouting and screaming, their faces distorted with rage. We see intolerance. We see barbarism. And, of course, what we see is true, but it's such a small part of the truth. It is as if the rest of the world only understood America, I won't say by the Tea Party, but I guess I just did, or by the KKK, or by some radical skinhead group or biker bar in San Bernardino. It is not that there is no Muslim rage. There is. And Islam is, in this century, militant, fundamentalistic Islam is, in this century, an organizing principle for discontent. But it is not all of Islam. It is not the religion. There is nothing more horrendous in the Quran than in Hebrew scriptures or in the Gospels or in the writing or in the Pauline material. Our holy texts are Rorschach tests that you can find what you want. And when you look at the world of Islam, it's huge. It's the largest, fastest growing religion in the world. And we see a small, non-representative, but dangerous faction within it. And we generalize that there is something unique about it. Something unique in the Quran that isn't in the religious DNA of any other religion. You can only believe that if you haven't read any of the scriptures of any of the other religions. You know, the Hebrew scriptures are pretty full contact and tough. For those of you who think that God of scripture is infallible, God spends half the Hebrew scriptures going, "Doh, what was I thinking?" God looks at creation and sees people are drunk and debauched and doing terrible things, and God decides to wipe out humanity, except for Noah's family. Well, that's pretty tough stuff. God decides to wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah for its sins, whether there are 100 or 60 or 50 or 20 righteous men or not. It's mass punishment. Moses is instructed by God to wipe out 10% of the men on the Exodus for backsliding and building the golden calf. It's a pretty tough room, folks. The men of Shechem are slaughtered. Throughout the scriptures, it gets pretty tough. And people start generalizing about the Quran being uniquely violent. I don't think so. You look at the story of Jesus, and he is bound to the wood, and the knife or the spear is not stayed, and the death is completed. You look at the apocalyptic materials and Revelation and all of the extravagant punishments for not believing, which means, incidentally, not believing as I tell you to believe. Because what does the Quran say? What do the Christian scriptures say? What do Hebrew scriptures say? What people tell you that it says. We don't agree on what the Constitution of the United States says, and it's written pretty much in the same English we speak. And Mr. Justice Ginsburg and Mr. Justice Scalia and Madam Justice Ginsburg read completely different constitutions on the same ink. So that when we look at our holy scriptures, we are looking at a Rorschach test. Tell me what you are looking for, and you can find it. We look at the world out there, and we see all the news, but the Muslims are yelling and screaming that a 14-year-old girl is shot in the head. There are terrible riots in Egypt, horrible things in Libya. Terrible things are happening, and we make the religion uniquely responsible for it and believe they can never be re-educated to civilization. There were the Crusades. Remember? I don't mean personally, I mean just in general. There was the Inquisition. was Christianity tameable, civilizable? There was the Shoah, the Holocaust. We don't associate it and blame all of these internecine wars in Europe with Christianity. But when we see Muslims acting crazy, we assume it is inherent in the DNA of the religion. It's inherent in the DNA of human beings who find reasons to hate and fear and therefore oppress the stranger. The stranger in terms of ethnicity, in terms of nationality, and in terms of religion. We look at all of the violence that Muslims are perpetrating, a tiny percentage of the Muslim population, and we commit the logical fallacy of the undistributed middle. Okay, I'll give you the simple version of that. You all know, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. In its form, that's a true syllogism. If I said, all Russians are communists, and I am a communist, therefore I am a Russian, you would understand that there's something wrong with that reasoning. That middle proposition is not distributed in the right way. We look at the news and say, all those terrorists are Muslims. Ahmed is a Muslim. Ergo, Ahmed is a terrorist. No more than I'm a Russian. A small percentage, and a way that we are manipulated into fearing the whole and not reacting to the part, the small part. And it is not any more rough, tumble, and irrational than anyone else's faith. The question that I'm asked most often, there are a couple of them. One is about female genital mutilation. It's not in the Quran. The second is about the veil. It's not in the Quran. What Hebrew scriptures say, what Paul says, and what the Quran says is all the same. Women should dress modestly. Well, is that sexist? Yes, of course. It was written by men, and men define what is modesty. And in some, it's a hijab. In some, it's a burqa. In some, it's a wig, a shaitel. In some, in Italy, again, it's not a hijab, but it's a scarf. I was teaching a course to a group of Jewish religious educators. And in this group of about 500-600 educators, there were 6 Muslim women. And I couldn't tell the Muslim women from the Orthodox Jewish women because they dressed exactly the same. Of course, I did ask them, you know, what are you doing here? And their answer was, well, we're trying to teach a language, a religion, and a culture in a strange land, and the Jews invented this wheel. We don't need to invent it. We can just copy it. And everybody felt really good about that. And it was a nice moment of promise, a nice moment of cooperation. Our common humanity and inhumanity are not particularly related to those holy scriptures. We can find all the reasons to distrust the stranger, all the reasons to fear them, all the reasons for violence. But that's us finding them. The last and most often asked question that I get when I teach courses on Islam is, does the Quran say that you can kill the non-believer? And the answer is yes and no. The word for non-believer is kafir, and it doesn't mean literally non-believer. It means the person who is offered salvation and covers themselves up from it. It did not, and here I get very Scalia, the original intent was not that it applied to Jews or to Christians, who are all people of the book, Nas al-Kitab. It applied to pagans. Now, for the pagans among you, that's not necessarily good news. But what's happened is that the word has gone from a very specific historic meaning into anybody who disagrees with me, Jew, Christian, or fellow Muslim. We look at Islam and say, it's this one great threatening religion. And with some sophistication, most of us know that it's divided into Sunni and Shia, and that the Sunni are about 83% of the Muslim population, and the Shia about 12. There's an odd number in there of heterodox sect. That's like saying that Christianity is divided simply into Protestant and Catholic. There are a dozen kind of Catholics, but we only think of Roman, and there are thousands of Protestants who have all different kinds of beliefs. So when the question is, what do Muslim believe, comes up, the answer is, it depends, from mosque to mosque, from who is interpreting the hadiths, the stories of Muhammad, who is interpreting the Quran, what does it say, what does the American Constitution say. It's up to individual communities. So you take this large, complex religion, and we just do the Gordian knot of saying, okay, it's just Islam. The newest wrinkle in Islamophobia came over my desk this last week, where I was told Islam is in crisis because of all of the inbreeding. There are cousins are marrying cousins. And so Islam has run in, this is a racist argument, basically saying that their gene pool has been exhausted. This is really strange for an evangelical faith that is all over the world, that involves higher percentage representation of different ethnicities than almost any other faith. But they make that argument. Well, you can make that argument two ways. If you want to say that cousins marrying cousins leads to bad things, you can prove that. The House of Windsor and every other royal house in Europe. Or if you want to say cousins marrying cousins can lead to, well, arguably good things, which is attorneys and doctors, you look at the Jewish experience in Eastern Europe. This is an irrelevant and racist slur. The world is dangerous enough. There are real issues out there, but when we try to sort by religion, when we only recognize the loudest and most extreme voice as spokespeople for a faith, we make a terrible, terrible decision. It is intellectually lazy and it is downright dangerous. We have a choice. Islam is a fast-growing faith, and we will live together or we will die together. We will build bridges or we will burn bridges. The preferable policy seems to me to be obvious. In Deuteronomy 30:15, it says, every day I put before you the choice of life and death, that ye may choose life, that you and your children shall live. If we and our children are going to live, we need to see the complexity and the humanity in each other and not let Christianity be defined by skinheads or by morons that make propaganda films, and not let Islam be defined by terrorists, but defined by the vast majority of decent human beings who are members of those faiths. Now you can say, let's just throw out religion, it's the problem. Well, you can throw out religion, you still have ethnicity, you still have tribe, you still have nation, and God help us, you still have sports teams that you can yell and scream and now kill over. Every day we have the choice of life and death, that we may choose life and peace and not burning but building bridges. At the end of the story in Genesis, when Father Ibrahim dies, Isaac and Ishmael come together in peace to bury their father. It is a moment of promise. It is a model of hope. Yeah, I know with Thanksgiving coming up, we have that wonderful first Thanksgiving where pilgrims and Native Americans got together for a meal, and it was only a moment, and it held a promise, and that promise was not kept. It is not too late for America to keep that promise, and it is vital that the world keep that promise of Ishmael and Isaac coming together, not simply to bury a parent, but to honor their common parent, our common parent, and to grow that moment from a moment to a meal, to a day, to a month, to a year, to a life together. Because we will live together or face the alternative. That's what it is to be a fellow human being in a very complex world.